and tonic, anyone?
Yes, I'll have one.
It's useless, you know. He's projected.
What do you mean, projected?
Well, every one of us has a certain image we project to others, right? Well, this is the image we project. Well, none of us are real. He's not real. We're all projected.
I'm not projected.
What did you say?
I said I'm not projected. I'm not projected. I'm not projected. I'm projected.
Particle man, particle man, doing the things a particle can. What's he like? It's not important. Particle man, is he a dot or is he a speck? When he's underwater, does he get wet? Or does the water get him instead? Nobody knows. Particle man. Triangle man hates particle man. They have a fight, triangle wins, triangle man. Universe man, size of the entire universe man, they're blind to smaller man. Universe man, he's got a watch with a minute hand, millennium hand, and an eon hand, and when they meet, it's a happy land. Powerful man, universe man. Person man. Hit on the head with a frying pan, lives his life in a garbage can. Person man, is he depressed or is he a mess? Does he feel totally worthless? Who came up with person man? Degraded man, person man. Triangle man hates person man. They have a fight, triangle wins, triangle man.
David, I sent a link through chat. I think I sent this to Alan, and Alan, I don't know if you looked at it, because I was at work and it struck me, so I sent it to you because I had a little break. But I substitute teach, and this my school's website, I linked there, and the main page has...
Oh, shit, a RAM in a cube. It's totally to fill in base.
Wow. And then the monolith behind it. It's wild. That it didn't even strike me before that day.
Yeah, they got some madmen working for them.
Yeah, right. And what's funny is like a lot of my duties there, it's just kind of like staying in the halls and making sure kids aren't skipping. A lot of my time is just spent like walking around in circles, and the floor is, of course, square tiles. And so it's just like layers and layers of meaning upon meaning, uh-huh. At least for me. So that was fun to see that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is that the RAM is super important. Even in, we're talking about Solomon's Temple, like the ram's horn, you blow into a ram's horn, right? I mean, that's a whole, but literally what the ram's horn is connected to and everything that it's represented by, it's huge. Like if you're wrapping the tefillin strap down your arm, they look at that as the spiral of the ram's horn, as a serpent, and they connect the serpent with the ram and all this kind of business, or depending on who you talk to. But I find it really interesting that literally, what are you looking at with the ram's horn? You're looking at this spiral, and they say that this is the universe. They're representing the universe with a spiral as far back as you can go, you know? And so that's interesting.
I love this here. It's like in one of the images on the cube, the ram is cut off, so it just says Ra, so you have like your sun square, and in this thing that says got dat ram swagga, all the vowels are sort of in a different color, so you have like the Hebrew alphabet, which doesn't, you know, which sort of doesn't spell out the vowels. It's just pretty interesting. And then even from the technological side, like something I've thought about a lot of times is like we have in computers, we have REM and RAM, which of course we have, you know, both a REM sleep and the RAM, like you have this sort of dreaming goat figure. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but it's like here you have the technological cube symbolized by the RAM, the random access memory,
yeah,
in our dreaming space.
And also, when you think about how memory is stored in a computer, it's magnetic storage, and magnetism always coalesces into loops. The lines of force are always closed in. They're loopy magnetic lines of force. And that's how we imprint stuff onto materials with magnetism.
Yeah, Mark LeClaire, who we had him on like one of our earliest episodes, I think it was episode 4, he was talking about the idea of tying in Philip K. Dick, the cube, and this sort of Valis loop. He was saying it's both a cube, it's a Valis cube, but it's also, you can think of it as a magnetic reel-to-reel, and that you reach one end of the loop, it sort of starts over. So you have all this, and then there's the idea that even magnetism and magic, whether this is intentional or not, I've heard different theories on it, but that similar sort of etymology of the magi, that there's a connection between the magnetism and magic.
I've never heard that.
Oh, certainly. I mean, well, I haven't heard that either, but I mean, like, if you think about, well, what is magic? Is it like levitating? Is it doing stuff like that? Well, what is levitation when you really think about it? And if we're talking about just manipulating the quantum vacuum, obviously magnetism is a component of that. So the magic falls in between, it's a middle ground between scientific manipulation of space and our environment versus compared with do we understand it or not. I mean, magic is really just a technology that we're unfamiliar with.
Right, that was Arthur C. Clarke, right? Any sufficiently advanced technology will be seen as magic.
Yep.
Right.
Now, here's a little funny thing. I work in downtown Asheville, around the corner from where I work. Apparently, you guys know who Harry Anderson is from Night Court?
Yeah.
Apparently, he lives like 2 blocks away from me.
And
he's going to open, around the corner from where I work, he's going to open a magic shop.
What?
Now, think of it this way. The Night Court. As I'm looking at this starry black sky, like you have the court. Like, we could take this to the Egyptian, you know, concept of death and the underworld and being judged in the dead. To be in the night court or the starry night sky, the court of Nuet or we can play with that. But just the idea that you have this magical night court seems really interesting. And again, you have the classic idea of the magician pulling the rabbit out of the hat, or the rabbit going through the Stargate, etc., etc., etc. But I'm just sort of astounded by the synchronicity of Harry Anderson going to open a fucking magic shop around the corner.
Sure, yeah, that's hilarious. Because he was the judge on the show, right?
Yeah.
Wow, okay, yeah, that's funny as hell. Because he was a magician on the show, wasn't he?
Well, I think he was like I think in real life he was like a sort of comedian / magician.
But he did magic on the show. Like,
correct.
That
yes.
was his interest.
Yeah.
Okay. It's been a while.
Oh, for me too. And what was the big guy that was with him? Isn't
Bull.
His name like Bull?
Yeah.
The big bald guy, Bull. So here you have like Osiris and the Apis Bull sort of joining at some point. Osiris assimilates the bull into himself. It's just like this whole like land of the dead. And again, I don't know. I doubt very much. As much as I remember of Night Court, I doubt very much that they were incorporating Egyptian symbolism into their sitcom. But you know, maybe.
But you know what though? I'll tell you what. The fucking I just rewatched Apocalypse Now back to back with Silence of the Lambs. And in response to Subliminal Synchrosphere's statements around them containing Egyptian symbolism, and it is so ridiculously, insanely overt. I have no question as to the intentionality of those, but I don't know about Night Court.
Was there? oh god, I'm gonna just have to Google this. I feel like there was, oh, I know there was a cartoon called Science Court. I think it was called Science Court. Yes. So here's the thing. I used to really enjoy the cartoon called Home Movies, mm-hmm. right? And I watched like a fuckload of that. And then it wasn't until the last year that I went and I've watched those episodes so many times. I was like, all right, I want to see what else these guys did. I remember they did Science Court and they did Dr. Katz. Yeah. So I watched Dr. Katz, like the whole series straight through. And it is fantastic. But what's struck me about Dr. Katz is it answered a question for me of the intentionality. All right, in Home Movies, the first two seasons are done in squiggle vision, and then at some point they drop that, and like, you could see like some executive decisions have been made. And starting in, I believe it's the third season, suddenly the kid's wearing like a 33 jersey, and in one of his like video plays, his name is Mason, and they're like, oh, Mason, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, is this like intentional? And it kind of, there was enough of it that I'm like, it was a question mark, but not super overt. Well, in Dr. Katz, they force a 33 into every fucking frame of that series. And I'm telling you, I watched all 88 episodes. They just shove 33s in your face to the point where it's like, I get it. Okay, leave me alone. And this is where things like when someone says, you know, is it intentional, is it synchronicity? I'm totally open to, there is no doubt there are intentional uses of symbolism. And you can kind of see, like, I even watched something recently that sort of made me curious was my wife had borrowed a DVD of this movie called Serenity. Is anyone familiar with that? It's like a...
Yeah.
So apparently there was a TV show called Firefly, and then it got canceled, and they made a movie called Serenity. So I had never seen any of this stuff, so we watched. There's only 14 episodes, of course, 14 pieces of Osiris. They make references to the planet Osiris, and at some point they dive down into Isis canyons and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, while, like, basic, like, the basic archetypal key phrases were there, it wasn't overtly anything. And then, you know, I kind of keep an eye out for, like, numbers in the background and stuff like that. Throughout the whole series, the 14-episode series, which is a low-budget, lower-budget, probably more independently made thing, there's no obvious numerical, like, sync drops. And then we put the movie on, which is now has Universal Pictures and a multi-million dollar budget, and, like, right away I see that they have this new craft, and it's, like, it has the number, like, 311-42. And I'm like, okay, all right. It's like, and it's like suddenly all this shit's like dropping in. The at the end of the movie, they discover this main thing, which was basically something that was supposed to pacify the population, but it ended up turning half of them into like essentially like zombies. And the thing is, G23 was the name of the serum. Yeah. Now, so you have obviously your 23 enigma, but what is G is also the seventh letter. So 723, mm-hmm. being your Robert Anton Wilson's serious contact date and all the other loaded stuff around that number. And here suddenly the 723 is like the major revelation of this show. And I'm like, it's just weird. So when you see that somehow like the people who are first starting to play with it are obviously not doing this intentionally, like watching all 14 episodes and none of that was there, or what was there was pretty like basic, and then suddenly you get the multi-million dollar budget and all these classic quote-unquote sync resonators are popping up, it's a good question mark for me of, well, what, you know, what does someone else think that means? Like if they're doing this intentionally, what does that mean? And I was talking to Will Morgan about it. He was saying the other possibility there is that because you have with a low-budget TV show, you might have one fraction of the viewership, and it's only when you get the big-budget movie that you're getting a lot more consciousness focused on it. Again, I don't know if I necessarily agree with this theory. I'm just going to put it out there, is that because you have so many more people watching a mainstream Hollywood movie, you've now brought that much more consciousness into it. You know, if we're talking about collapsing a wave function or the observer, how does the observer influence things? If you have 10 people looking at something versus 100,000 people looking at something, how does that change the wave function of that product? Does that make any sense?
Yeah,
that's an interesting hypothesis. I never thought of it like that, but that, for me, that works in a way that's a bit different than like everyone collapsing the wave function. So getting back to David Bohm a little bit, like he has the idea of the implicate order, which is an outgrowth of his hidden variable theory of quantum physics that he formulated in like 1952, which was an extension of Louis de Broglie from like the 1920s. And it's not a fully objective view of quantum physics, but there's basically two interpretations or interpretations of quantum physics at work. You have the many worlds, which is basically, you know, everything that could happen is happening in all these parallel universes. And it's just, to me, that is, I'm open to other dimensions, but it also sounds like a cop-out. And the scientists that adopt it, they don't see how strange an idea that is for a scientific point of view, as far as they see science and then how they deride other things as being pseudoscientific. Just because there's math behind it doesn't mean shit, because for years you could mathematically formulate that, you know, the sun went around the earth or something like that. You can make anything out of mathematics. So to say, oh, well, it's mathematically verified, I never buy that.
If it wasn't for Krishnamurti, do you think that he would be more well-received?
I think he was basically pushed to the wayside after the 50s when, like, the McCarthy hearings started coming after him as a communist, and he was forced out of mainstream academia in a lot of ways. Now, he was still brilliant enough and still accepted enough where his ideas were still discussed, and he was even invited to, you know, Bohr's Institute, and he gave talks there, and he was obviously still able to publish and put through the hidden variable theory, but at the same time, and certainly, like, getting into ideas of consciousness and stuff, that's always going to stereotype you in the eyes of your contemporaries if you're a scientist, especially then. Because not only was he questioning the idea, the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics, which was, especially in the 50s, almost career suicide. I forget exactly when he started talking to Krishnamurti, maybe the 70s, 60s. That's only did more to, I guess, make him fringe. But at the same time, he was never fringe because, you know, he was good friends with Richard Feynman. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stories about how they hung out. And, like, Feynman looked to Bohm as an authority on a lot of things, especially philosophical questions. And so you're right. I agree with you that, yes, probably to a degree. But I think it's almost, I'm sure some scientists don't even know that he had those discussions with people.
Well,
had those discussions.
It just reminds me of what, like, Alan was saying earlier about how people associate, because he has somebody in his book, people associate him with that person. People will see that somebody's shaking hands with somebody or knows somebody who's supposed to be their quote unquote enemy. And then they're like, well, how could you do that? And it's like, well, fucking, it's a small world and people are in the same fields and you go up high enough and everybody fucking knows each other. But I could see how there could be a really strong case from people with all the dialogues of Bowman and Krishnamurti with all these scientists that if they, you know, not everybody knows the history of Krishnamurti involving his prophesied birth with the Theosophical Society, Madame Blavatsky, and people will associate it more with Alice Bailey, though it's Madame Blavatsky because she took over that facet, or she her Lucis Trust is an extension from the Theosophical Society. But anyways, not to get too off track here, people have a lot of conspiratorial ideas concerning the Lucis Trust. And when we're talking about the Lucis Trust, we're not talking about sewing circles on a smaller level where people read Alice Bailey books and come together and talk about it and it's super boring, but rather what's stationed at the UN as the Lucis Trust headquarters and what their deal is, you know? that I don't know what their deal is, but I could, you know, only I could imagine, you know, because they had that meditation hall and their whole deal. Like, it's a trip, you know. They were there for the founding of the UN. Like, they're the secret order of the UN, even though everyone knows about them, you know. So the fact that you could connect them then to Krishnamurti, though he renounced his position, yet went on to teach his whole life. So he's like, I'm not the world teacher, but then becomes a world teacher for however many years, you know. And then to connect that to David Bohm then and everything that he has to offer, because I mean, I'm holding Wholeness in the Implicit Order in my hand, and I was kind of, I read a paragraph in between things here, kind of. I read a paragraph in the course of this entire conversation, pretty much, just kind of had my mind blown a little bit, just because the implications of the implicit order are huge. You know, it's an enfolded space. Everything, the whole, is folded up in every part, so to speak. I wouldn't give it justice by oversimplifying right now, but yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of going on a tangent here, but.
No, that's cool. Hey, it's like, it's nonlinear. That's kind of the character of the thing. So that's okay.
Totally.
Anyway, the implicate order in terms of like how it focuses attention on a thing and might, like, again, bring these kind of archetypes more to the surface. It's, again, that whole idea of the implicate order is there's a wholeness to everything. Everything is connected through the quantum potential, people, particles, everything. He equated it to an ocean where, you know, you have an ocean wave and it crashes in. And so even though it's in a localized event, when you really think of the whole, it has changed the whole. You can't avoid a single thing changing the dynamics of the entire structure.
Right. So that's the variable aspect. He's like, mm-hmm. not variables aren't, they don't realize the implication of many of the variables that come up. They see them as a problem rather than seeing their meaning.
Right. And through that approach too, I mean, he was able to resolve a number of like paradoxes, including like the wave particle duality, where yes, there's, he views particles as kind of like an excitation of the background of space. So in that way they're connected, but they're still separate things in a way. But their movements through space and so on are always guided by what's below. So again, a wave is a structure, but it's never separate from the continuum itself. It's just a topological feature. And while it seems to have an identity, it ultimately is going to like go back into the continuum, become a part of that, and then become unfolded again and enfolded. And it's a constant process. So if these archetypes, again, are embodiments of creation, and that like they're the numbers and the ratios and everything is embodied in creation itself, mm-hmm. Well, if everything is focused on a certain thing, then it makes sense to me that those numbers and those ratios, which are archetypal and primordial and give rise to reality as we know it, they would probably pop up in media more so than at other times. Because sometimes I have a hard time wrapping my mind around the idea that all these writers are consciously doing it. Or even like, not all of them, but just even if a small percentage would do it, I'm like, well, why? Unless they're similar to our perspective, which I'm not ruling out. I'm sure there's a number of them that get into this subject matter and they just kind of incorporate it and weave it into their artwork. A lot of times these guys are just kind of like corporate shills that are just kind of droning around and not, I don't think there's a lot of thought behind what they're doing beyond getting a paycheck. So I always have a hard time like, well, why would they be educated in this kind of school of thought unless they're doing it themselves? And not that I have disrespect for other people's intelligence or stuff, but also this is like material that, unless you're in a mystic school or something, or you've really bought into that whole idea, I don't see how you could just stumble across it. I see it more as just kind of coming out unconsciously, more so than anything else.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of like perfect, I mean, a perfect example, and it's a stupid example, but it's a perfect example, is as I was sort of reading the Night Court Wikipedia page, it's talking about how the character Harry Anderson played is Harry T. Stone, which I think is interesting. You have like the stone that the builders rejected. One of the, in the first season, you have public defender Sheila Gardner, the gardener. You have like, you have Gardner and Fielding. The guy who plays Bull, his first name is Nostradamus, so it's Nostradamus, but is his real name, but he goes by Bull. And like all these sort of like, okay, you know, slight little quasi-esoteric things. But here, one of the defining characteristics of Judge Harry T. Stone is that Harry loved movies and fashions from the 1940s, was vocal in his disdain for modern music, especially Barry Manilow, and idolized crooner Mel Torme. And when you go to Harry Anderson's Wikipedia page, there's a thing here that says, a longtime Mel Torme fan, Anderson gave the eulogy at the singer's funeral. So that's how big of a fan he was, right? Judge Stone in Night Court was also a Torme fan. The show's creator, Reinhold Wedge, says the fact that Anderson was also a Torme fan was completely coincidental. You know, so it's like, that's the kind of thing where it's like, you would have no reason to fake that or make that up. It's just a weird coincidence. You know, like, I don't see the plot in, you know, the Illuminati agenda in having the judge on Night Court be a Mel Torme fan. You know, like, there's... I really, like, it could be, but I really doubt it.
Well, you could argue that it's certain intelligences that have been conjured and set loose, spread out in their language of synchronicity. And it was the Illuminati folks that brought them into our dimension. But that's scary and not worth thinking too much about.
Well, I mean, right under that, it says Anderson moved to New Orleans in 2002. He and his second wife, blah, blah, blah. Okay. In the summer of 2005, Anderson also opened a nightclub in the French Quarter called Oswald's Speakeasy, located at 1331 Decatur Street, blah, blah, blah. Now, you have Lee Harvey Oswald's New Orleans connection, and then you have this 1331, which
313 kill shot.
Yeah, you have like
or 131.
13 being the death card, 313 being the Zapruder death shot. I believe there's also in Oswald. Let's actually look it up. Lee Harvey Oswald's mugshot. I believe has. I know Mark LeClaire did a thing on this.
Is it the 723? Does he have that on there?
Sorry. Oswald has the 723 in his mugshot. Right. You're right.
Jim Morrison has a 237.
Right.
Which weirded me out just really quickly.
I think it's the rifle is like exhibit number, you know, 313 or it's like something ridiculous, whatever it is. And it doesn't matter. I'm just saying, like, you know, there's weirdness abound, and at what point do you want to, you know, credit intentionality? I feel like at some point there's no way to know.
No,
it's the hardest thing about this. Like, I go back and forth every day, like, you know, writing about 9/11, and it's like, here you have flight, you know, 77 and flight 93, and then, you know, one of the planes hits on the 77th floor and one of the planes hits on the 93rd floor, and it's like, someone's got to be playing a fucking, like, this has got to be intentional ritual here. And at the same time, I don't know, is it so, like, you know, I'm open to either, and I'm like, there comes a point where things get so weird and you're like, how will I ever know?
Well, you know, there's the idea that, first of all, magic, just as a... I'm having a weird time because I'm hearing my voice echo. I hope it doesn't come out in the recording. But anyways, the magic is to move nature in accordance with the will, right? So the individual's will to move. So, like, Crowley would say that potato farming is essentially magic, but that there's... You can apply the same principle to different etheric levels. And so then that becomes an influence on the levels that are emanating from those etheric levels. So the dense levels are affected by the etheric plane. So when changes and intentions are introduced on the etheric plane, that affects everything else. That it's like a cause and effect relationship. So that's an idea. I don't know how true or how far you want to go with that and where that actually is occurring and how exactly, but...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, like, Andras Jones was on Vinny Eastwood's show, and he was talking about his White House Matrix, you know, album sync. And what he talks about is, like, that no one had, you know, he made this very specific playlist to try putting over this movie, And it's synced up perfectly to the point where you would say, you know, if this was something that wasn't his own playlist, you would have thought, like in the case of, in Your Melancholia and Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, it's like there's a real question of, like, did someone plan this? Is this intentional? Or Dark Crystal and Pink Floyd? It's like where you start to go to the point of, did someone do this on purpose? But when it's something that you create your own playlist, or the experience I had with watching Little Nemo, a cartoon with a shuffle function on my iTunes, and I knew that no one had ever tried that, you know, like no one had that play set before, and yet it was so perfect that every 2 minutes my wife and I would sit up and bolt up out of our seats and go, holy shit, did you see that? Mm-hmm. You know, when things like this happen, your natural inclination is to go, this has to be intentional. And Andras's point was that he couldn't help but see something like those movie album syncs, couldn't help but make him think of something like 9/11, where you have the same thing where the symbolism is so explicit that you're almost, you know, your obvious gut reaction is to go, this has got to be intentional. And the implications of it very often is not intentional, at least not on the hand of a human manipulator, like not someone planting these things intentionally, but if you want to go into higher orders of consciousness, awareness, or nature of reality. But you get what I'm saying? It's like yeah. there's sometimes when a synchronicity is so explicit, you have to, you'd be crazy in a sense to not think at some point someone's fucking with me, or this right. is intentional.
It's the,
or whatever.
The hidden hand. It's the third hand.
Yeah. Right? Absolutely.
So yud 42, 14, 14, 14, the hidden hand of Vesica Rabbit. So that's the idea that you, the notion that you have the hidden hand of government, you know, where you have the two poles all the time, and then there's a third one that's actually the thing that's influencing and making the decisions. And then you have that idea in Judaism of that you have the two hands, and then there's another hand that's influencing, that's, you know, the that secret, you know.
And even something like the World Trade Center, right? This is your, like, your financial center of the world. And what do we even or the height, you know, the symbolism of capitalism, like why? Not just pretending for a minute that the official story of, you know, 19 Saudi terrorists trying to attack this thing, why would they do it? Well, I mean, the more obvious reason would be because of our military bases in Saudi Arabia. But there's, you know, even if you want to go a step further, is with the official story, is like, oh, because they were trying to attack the symbol of American authority, right? This symbol of capitalism and American financial might. Well, what do we call capitalism, or what is the major phrase associated with capitalism? But the hidden hand of the market.
Yep.
So if the World Trade Center is your modern day market, to have the hidden hand at play in the market is pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I've been meaning to tell you that I was incorrect in when you were inquiring to me about Yud and Kaf and how they're both hand and one is, you know, palm and open. Whatever I told you, it was the reverse. So I believe that Kaf is actually the open hand, and I said it was the closed hand. And it's not really that it's open and closed, it's just that they say palm. And so you're like, oh, okay, palm, that sounds like an open hand, you know. It's not that the other one isn't necessarily, yud is fist or anything. But that is really interesting in terms of that, where do we see Kaf show up in tarot? But fortune, which is like, you know, the Wheel of Fortune card. So if you get your fortune, you read it on your palm. It just so exactly. happens that palm is fortune, so there you go.
Yeah, but if you look at the images, I'm tempted to think that the pictogram doesn't seem to depict like the actual palm that you would read, but it's more of the palm from a side view. So it is like the hand that grips the wheel. It, you know, so it's like the question would be, is it actually the face of the palm, or just the open hand, or maybe the...
But isn't it interesting in the first place that Kaf and well, fortune is related to Jupiter, so that's the Jupiter card, and how funny it is that then that it would be a hand at all, because, you know, if you are making that jump that the Jupiter symbol in alchemy is an amalgamation of a 4 and a 2, that you have three hands make up the 42, and so of course fortune right before the loop around where you have the
Can you back up? Extend, what do you mean three hands make 42?
14. So yud, if you spell out yud in Hebrew, which is hand, you get 14, which is, you know, I've talked about this several times on the show, where you have it's 14 segments that surround the Rosicrucian cross, which when folded up becomes the cube. There's 14 segments on the fingers of the hand. So if you count you got three on each finger and two for your thumb is the way that they do that. So that your hand is literally associated with the cube of space. And so then this is, so then you have 14 plus 14 plus 14 is 42. So three hands equals 42.
Oh, beautiful. Right. So, and of course, pi being 3.14, but if you make that 3 times 1.4.
Yeah, I never thought of that. Huh, that's interesting. And isn't it interesting that Neo gets 3 minutes and 14 seconds to meet with the architect in The Matrix Reloaded, which isn't just in that case pi, it's literally that what is he doing in that room where everything's being reflected back to him and he's on television? And the architect is literally the Metatron? Oh, and Shaddai is valued at 314, which is the same value of Metatron. Metatron is valued at 314. There you go.
What do we also associate with magic but sleight of hand? Like, the whole idea of the hidden hand and magic also go together, even in a modern day, like a Harry Anderson-style magic trick. You know, if you were going to do, like, make a coin disappear or whatever, it's all sleight of hand.
Yeah. Whoa. yeah, and you pull a rabbit out of the hat. That's like the most common magic trick I could think of, is pulling a rabbit out of a hat. It's kind of an interesting thing in this line with Playboy in 2001. That's like the ultimate magic trick. It's like, I can't figure that out. There's like a few places where things come up in terms of future predicting that are unreconcilable. And this is why I have some understanding of, I actually sent Subliminal Synchrosphere a message asking about how it is that he equates Kabbalah straight up with sorcery. So he's like black magic of the Orthodox Judaism, which I disagree with, though I wouldn't say that the tools of Kabbalah aren't utilized in different ways by people with different motivations, oriented in different ways. What he came across with the little girl in Poltergeist with the poster of the Super Bowl that fucking happens years later, and then she gets sick during the Super Bowl and dies right afterwards, that it's like you have a Super Bowl poster for a Super Bowl that hasn't happened yet in a early film, and then the girl in the room, it's her room, she fucking, like, I can't, and then everything on top of it, like, for days, she puts on the Rams helmet and everything. It's like, I can't reconcile that. In the same way, I can't reconcile 2001 A Space Odyssey having that fucking Hilton sign with the monolith desk in the space station, and then that's below Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite, like, that's the floor is their ceiling, and then they're like, you can't tell which side is up and which side is down here. Like, Haywood Floyd says that, you know, like, and then the fact that you have the Millennium Hilton right in front of the two towers in 2001, like, every element is there. It's like, what? Like, I don't know, I can't wrap my mind around that, and so I'm like, what is that?
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. It's like I'm stuck. Sometimes I get in these places where I'm like, I don't know how that couldn't be intentional. How do you reconcile that thought? And this stone, this Hilton of Cadbol stone, you know, it sort of strikes me. And this is just off the cuff, pure speculation. I'm not, just throwing it out as a possibility, what if Kubrick was referencing this thing? Like, what if Kubrick put in the Hilton sign as a sort of double entendre of like, okay, here's a space station, who would be, you know, what hotel chain would have a hotel in space? Oh, the Hilton, and then I can reference this slab of stone, et cetera, et cetera. Again, pure throwing it out there's a possibility. What if he put the Hilton there to reference this slab as a monolith, and yet it ends up playing out that this actual slab gets completed in 2001, that the actual building is there in 2001, that the 9/11 event happens in 2001. Like, is that predictive programming? Is that, you know, playing with something and then this, and because, you know, if we want to talk about Will Morgan's idea of like how much intention do you put into a movie, as Mike Cleland said, the 2001 is a movie everyone went to tripping fucking balls. So now you've made this thing into a magical ritual. Whether or not whatever the intention was beforehand that Kubrick might have put in, all the consciousness and altered consciousness that is applying their own powers of observation to this piece of media has undoubtedly made it all the more powerful. But I'm with you. It's like I have trouble sometimes reconciling these things, and yet I could see how all of these things are possibilities. Well, I might lean towards one more than another. I don't know. It's pretty fascinating.
Right. Like, I'll brainstorm and I'll say 1,000 things, but then you'll end up stumbling upon some nodal deal that doesn't, compute, because I... All right.
And the question in my mind is, like, why purposefully expose people to archetypes and ideas that I think all three of us realize that they are, foundationally speaking, they're meant to liberate the human mind. So if you're trying to control the human mind, why bother exposing them to all the symbolism in an effort to control them?
Right.
Because it really can't control people. It's the symbols themselves are not. Yeah, David, if you want to go off that.
No, I don't think that. I feel like what happened is we've set up this insane kind of our own version of reality for ourselves, as like in coping with our own fear of death, and that passing on our name, doing all the corporations, every fucking thing we can think of stems from that. And so, like, but that there is actually an underlying order in the midst of this order that we're trying to force onto reality. And so there's these reminders that what we're building is, like, we can't escape from the order, so we're projecting our own thing, but it's still ruling us. Like, that there's an order existing here, and that there's layers and layers to it, and that much of that order is still like extensions, although its source is pure, are infiltrated by various intelligences and forces or whatever you want to call it, and then that gets reflected back to us, and it's our own reflection of what we're playing with in order to do what we're doing. We're like conjuring our personalities, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think it's almost like the meaning we put on these things represents a fear of ourselves, like a fear of finding our higher selves. So if these symbols represent our higher selves, and basically the main issue with the human condition is overcoming the ego and finding what's beyond that, I think our instinct, again, depending on like what your spiritual perspective is, I tend to be like, take the more Gnostic perspective, non-denominational Gnostic, that Earth it's hellish. It's as close to a hell as you'll ever be in. And that what we're going through and the turmoil the world's in, it is, it's a university for the soul, right? So within that...
What is the man's, the sort of, I can't help but see him as the caretaker of The Shining in the cube, that guy who comes in like he's like the manager. I'm the manager of this whole institution. It's like, I'm the caretaker. I've always been here. But, I just couldn't help but separate that in my mind. Uh-huh. But
Right.
And John, what does that guy say to him when he says, oh, I'm sorry, I apologize. It actually isn't him who says it. It's the TV executive guy. And he says, oh, this is fantastic, the TV medium. And then he says, well, of course you're in a fiction. And he says, like, what do you mean I'm in a fiction? He goes, he's like, well, if you think about it, it's really the only logical answer. The only other alternative would be that you're insane.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of like, if your mind has to try and reconcile these two things, you're going to take that. I can't help but, again, like that's as hard for me to swallow as anybody. So I'm not trying to like put that out there to squash anybody's thing. It's just like, it's a pretty fascinating other little take on it. It's like sometimes when I think like, oh, we're trapped in this archetypal narrative and blah, 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 or that we're the people kind of in the story realizing we're in the story. And then it's like, well, it's that, or you're just fucking crazy.
Or both.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry. Please go on. I have to throw out the idea that the possibility that is that our logical answer, or is that like the answer that we can settle on? It's the least disagreeable answer. Does that make sense?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Sure. But I mean, if we're like embracing this idea that there is a hidden order and it's coming from another dimension, maybe not trillions of dimensions like quantum physics might say, but let's just say there's this world and a spiritual world. Okay. So it's not traditional heaven and hell, but there's something beyond, and it bleeds into our world. It gives some order to the chaos. I mean, I think it's the whole foundation of chaos theory. I mean, how can deterministic chaos even exist? That whole idea. If you map a system, a complex system, over a long enough time, and you give it like a topological diagram, it forms these patterns that keep looping back into themselves, and it keeps kind of repeating. So the end point, the beginning point, the end point are the same over and over again, but the space in between is filled with difference and novelty, and there's always free will within that inner space. Which again, you might equate to the vortex of the fluid, and then the endpoints, which you might equate to, the Solomon's pillars, or the damping principles, or the cube, or whatever. So there's a confinement, but a movement within the confinement. So there's always novelty and free will that coexist. But also, like within the cube in that movie, they say, well, especially when the musicians come in, they say you'll always be trapped, but they allude to you can get out when you die. Okay. So what does that mean? It means that that might insinuate that there's a graduation. There's a type of movement beyond. So we're always in it, but at the same time, like, we can become like those people who move in and out of the cubes effortlessly. And whether they're dead or not is an open question. And even like at some point in that movie, a really weird moment comes where it's like just 10 seconds and this creepy old guy opens the cube. Uh-huh. He's like, have you ever thought that this is what death is? And so that makes you question, okay, well, is this his life or is this his death? And where do you draw those lines? So, you know, your perspective is right, and I think, you know, mine is right. You can't decide. We have to decide for ourselves, and this is where the value judgments come in.
Beautifully said. I want to ask you one other thing. There's a slight sort of shift of pace here. You were talking before the value of, transcendent moments or mystical states of like how people have, whether it be for science or for the arts, that people have had these bursts of inspiration or visions and stuff like that. Do you, as someone who is maybe a little more on the scientific end than us, or at least understanding, would you say that the correlation between this sort of esoterica and scientific discoveries, do you see, or what's your opinion of a sort of, as our scientific understanding progresses, that we almost have to sort of reevaluate some of the more esoteric stuff? Like, is there, do you think that, by studying, I'm just, like, you know, a shitty example, but by studying Kabbalah, could we maybe have some discovery in spaceship design or whatever, And that's a very specific example, but I'm just saying, like,
oh, yeah. Well, let me bring up something I think we talked about before. It's this guy named John Searle. John Searle, in the, I think it was the 70s, but maybe it was the 60s. Anyway, he's from Britain, and he garnered a good amount of media attention in that decade for creating flying discs in and around England and flying them around using, he had this little station in a remote control station in a shed. But he was built these flying discs. There's pictures of them. And I've never seen them completely written off as hoaxes or anything like that. Maybe they are, maybe they aren't. But there's never been anyone that's really dissected them and been like, oh, this is obviously a hoax or this or that. And there's a good amount of attention on him during that time. So just to discard it as a hoax is kind of difficult in my mind to do. So anyway, he was building these discs and he was getting them to levitate. And, well, how was he doing it? Well, the foundational engine of these discs was what he called the Searle generator. And it is the construction of it. David, I'll get you the link for it in just a few minutes once I'm done ranting about it. But it's just concentric rings within larger concentric rings. And again, it's this this spiral principle embodied in a piece of technology, or this resonant structure, this ripple pattern, perfect circles within circles within circles, and then movement within the circles that create this anti-gravitational effect. And it also is said to gate ambient electrons through its magnetic cores to create extra energy. So it's both a generator and an anti-gravity device in one that was basically making these things fly and giving them power.
So you use superfluids? Like helium superfluid?
He was not using, no, he wasn't using any superfluid, but I'll say this much. He's, in descriptions of it, he said that it runs super cool, and as it gets faster, it gets cooler and cooler, and he's equated it to a superconductor, which is why I tend to see the fabric of space is kind of like a superconducting superfluid or a Bose-Einstein condensate. That is, I think, the best analogy for it. And the most sophisticated technologies try to mimic that. And so if we're mimicking both trying to create a superconducting environment plus embodying the whole harmonic principle of a resonant circular structure that is perfectly balanced, that is able to tap into the background environment that is self-similar to, you see this kind of, I've heard it referred to as like technological feng shui, or like the squares of a low shoe, where you're arranging the parts to mimic nature as best you can, and then it rewards you with all these anomalous and very cool behavior, whether it's anti-grav or extra or free energy or whatever you want to call it. So the Searle generator, it's like there's actually a group in California called Searle Magnetics, and this guy, he's an engineer, very, very honest sounding guy. It's a legitimate corporation. They have all this equipment. They're researching mostly the magnetic principles of the machine. And he started out just with the hope of replicating proofs of principle of not creating the whole machine, because when Searle made it, it required all this. He had worked for an electric company where he had access to all this free equipment, but it's millions of dollars worth of equipment. So it wasn't just this garage inventor. So it's a sophisticated piece of technology, but it's simple in that it mirrors nature. It mirrors organisms, this like liquid crystal harmonic principle that also tends to be like kind of a superconducting thing. And so when we try to mimic nature and we buy into this symbolism, again, like the pentagon or the circle or the square, and you arrange them in a particular way, you get rewarded. And interestingly enough, he had dreams. Okay, so this kind of goes back to the original question. How did he arrive at this whole idea in the first place? And he had dreams where he was playing hopscotch and he was jumping from square to square, kind of like the squares of low shoe. And the squares themselves and the numbers within the squares had a certain pattern and arrangement. And he came to find out that when you order the numbers within the squares, when you try to start out with order and you add them all up, you get out disharmony, you get out disorder. But if you input chaos into the squares in a certain way, what you get out is perfect order, basically like free energy or whatever you want to term it. So he played with those ideas.
I've thought many times of the hopscotch board being a variation on the Tree of Life.
Oh, yeah, totally. Every time.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's where you see science and mystical ideas merging into one. And while it's still at the fringes of science, I mean, it's there. And it's being played with. And there's enough evidence for me. I mean, you don't have a working generator yet, but I mean, Jesus Christ, we spend as much on, if we didn't build one bomb to drop on brown people for a day, we could probably give it to a guy like him just to find out if this stuff could be made. But we don't bother, and all we do is just like ridicule these people. But in another time, in another place, in another culture, you know, he would have been like a great shaman that if he had access to the technology we have access to. I mean, God,
I have a question for you. Have you ever heard that idea that in Einstein's field equations, working with unified field theory, or I guess maybe it was before that, but in his, where was it? I forget exactly where it was in his work, but he apparently hit a nasty infinity. The term meaning that it was an unreconcilable recursion that went on and on and on for fucking ever. And that he had not wanted to even publish it until it was reconciled. And that it was, I can't remember the name of the guy, but there was some guy who got a hold of his work and completed it as if it wasn't there.
And Schwarzschild.
Yeah, Schwarzschild, the Schwarzschild solution. So that, like, and then still there, right? I mean, it's like...
That's where black holes come from.
Right, so it's basically a black hole, right? And that it's just, it's in the mix, and it's I guess, technically chaos, but the order is all up around it. Like, their equation is obviously projected order, but then in the midst of it, it's actually a factor that it relies upon.
Yeah, and what I see that as a representation is, like, again, mathematics has its limitations, and it leads to philosophical revelations, just like you mentioned. It's like order, chaos, the coexisting of the two, and they can coexist. But also then, like, we say, well, math can tell us everything, or this highly logical approach, this linear, logical, mathematical, A plus B equals C, can get us to where we need to be. But when you see, like, even as something as sophisticated as Einstein's equations, a black hole represents a mathematical breakdown. It's really a postulate. There's really no direct physical evidence for black holes. We have some observations from our satellites and telescopes that seem to insinuate black holes. But what do we think of a black hole? We think of stuff getting sucked into it. But almost everything that we've labeled a black hole spits shit out all the time, radiation and matter. Like, we say we have a black hole in the center of the universe, but it's always radiating energy and matter. Like, what sense does that make? And there wasn't any sense until Hawking came around, and he didn't, I mean, I don't think he solved the paradox. He gave it a mathematical framework that made it plausible, I guess. But again, the paradox can't be gotten rid of. It's still, how can something be sucking stuff in and then spitting it out?
Well, because that's the galactic halo, right? The idea that, I mean, that we think of a galaxy and we think of the central disk with these arms of clusters of stars and light and energy, and that these arms actually stretch out and spread out into an enormous spiral that isn't as plain to see because they're spread out. So we see what's focalized in the central disk, but that those arms actually keep going and twist around to the, like, to the northern and southern, or the upper and lower, you know, points. And that there's actually, I've actually read about how many light years it is in between those furthest outskirts of the sphere and what we would call the galactic center, right? And that's one of the explanations, apparently, of the emergence. It's because everything gets broken down, and it's not, it's like, it's like a nominal thing. It goes into this other place and then and then reemerges in new form, is the idea, at least. I'm sure somebody could come along and explain it better.
No, there's a million. No, there's like a million names for it. You can call it the implicate order. You can call it hyperspace. Everyone, has a different conception of it, but this stuff seems to disappear to nowhere. But it also, and so in a way, like, it, this is what breaking out of the cube is. It's like you descend into the underworld and are able to kind of like tunnel through, you know, quantum tunneling. You're able to tunnel through the cube and move into a different space, but it's invisible. And so the cube keeps us penned into our 3D manifestation, but we're inherently non-local things. We're everywhere at once. That's an inescapable part of reality. It's just not perceptible. And that's like, I'm not too well versed in Robert Anton Wilson, but what I've heard of him, he seems to like touch on that quite a bit. And everyone I've read and I think has good ideas has been influenced by him more or less. So he talks about that a little bit too. So, you know, we're these non-local things, and this gets in the idea of everything's connected and everything emerges out of this space, and there's this ordered space, and what this order is, we can't say, or why it's there, we can't say, but it goes deeper than what we typically think of as reality. So it's super interesting.
Wow.
And then I'll
go ahead.
No, go ahead. No, please.
No, sir.
Go ahead. So I'll look up a couple pictures of, like, John Searle arrived at his idea by his formula. His mathematics is all based around these like Loschew squares, like this very sophisticated system of squares, and how those all kind of play into each other, and that formed the basis of the technology. So I'll actually find that for you, and I'll link them in chat so you guys can build off those ideas if you want while I'm looking for that.
It was pretty immediate watching the Henson's The Cube. Thinking of Salvador Dali's representation of the cubic rosy cross, so to speak, where Christ is nailed to these giant cubes, you know? It was like one of the first things that came in my mind. Probably relate to that. I mean, even...
And then, like...
John,
yeah,
can you spell Loschew?
L-O-S-H-U. It's two words. It's L-O space S-H-U.
I mean, literally that Yeheshua, Jesus... is Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh with a shin in the center, which is the tree. So the unfolded tree with the shin in the center, and then shin is equated in tarot with judgment, right? Where you have the three people emerging from the coffins in the Rider deck. In Crowley's deck, it's the eon, right? So it's moving into a different age is the idea that it's a transparency. He's trying to acknowledge what it means to move into a different age. It's not just like, poof, look where we are. It's that there's this kind of like transitionary tunnel, and that there's that one melds into the other. They morph in one into the next, which is just, I mean, obvious and reasonable, but we tend to be very limited. I mean, religions tend to be very limited in their scope of what an eon means, you know, and that's what that card's about. But I find that interesting that that's the center of it's also, as a pictograph, it's a canine tooth. So it's what you use to masticate something. So you're literally, in a sense, you're masticating tetragrammaton in the name Jesus. And then to equate that with the unfolded cube, the rosy cross, couldn't be more direct.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
And I guess just equating, going on another tangent, you know, whether Jesus is an archetype or he's a real figure, I mean, like, that's inconsequential to me. It's just the idea that's important. So the idea that if we adopt, like, Philip Dick's idea that Buddha, Jesus, all these Krishna, all these solar deities or these solar archetypes, that he calls them plasmites or plasmatics or whatever, that they are basically sent here to try to, bring our higher selves to the forefront, to like help us get in touch with our higher selves. And then again, going back to the Matrix, which is, I don't like to go to the Matrix too much, just because it's so obvious and it's such a good movie and so touches on so many points that I think it's like there's overkill, but I'm going to do it anyway. Because the point in the movie where he's like, he's in the simulation and they're like, well, if they know who you are, or you make your intentions revealed, they'll turn on you. And so, like, again, what do we do with all these prophets and stuff and all these people that bring like truth to the masses? They get murdered or they get ostracized, and I don't know if that's ever going to change. I wish it would, and I think maybe we're developing to a point where it won't be as bad, But at the same time, I think that's a lesson where it's like, it's worth paying attention to the people that are, that you are told are wrong, because Jesus was said he was wrong in his day. Buddha was told he was wrong in his way. And the powers that be told you, do not listen to these people. And only 1,000 years later, and in hindsight, are they celebrated as visionaries. And so, I mean, that's what draws me to these kinds of, like, you know, these weirdos or whoever you want to say. I mean, like, as long as I've ruled out that they're charlatans, or just, like, obviously trying to make money, and most of them are not. I think that's, like, a horrible stereotype that's put on a lot of these, like, scientific fields. Mm-hmm. I think they have something to say. And again, like, this idea of reality tunnels, even if everything they say is not correct, it's on you to take what you see as truth from their picture of reality and synthesize it with other things. So that requires you to be comprehensive in how you learn and how you study things. Yep. And to just, like, settle on one person's perspective. Like, I don't think David Bohm's right about everything. I don't think John Searle's right about everything. I don't think this guy's right about everything. Einstein is not a saint. Einstein is not a prophet. He has good ideas, but he's fallible. He's a human being. So we put these people on these pedestals and just be like, well, you know, we either have to just believe everything they say or say that they're wrong and this other person's right. But we have to be, again, to go back to Dick, he says that we're these, like, memory coils. As human beings, our purpose is to take in information, refine it, and spit it back out in a more refined form. And in that way, we, like, improve the world. So it's, like, about putting out good artwork. It's about putting out good writing. But to put out good writing or good artwork, you have to be able to filter it properly. And what we have is a crisis in filtering, I would say, because, like, there's no shortage of information, especially with the internet. It's wonderful. But it's also a curse in that there's almost too much of it. And schooling and culture in general do not teach you how to filter or to critically analyze information and to synthesize it. So that's, I mean, that's what I see my role as in the larger scheme of things. And that's why I like to dig into a lot of subjects and try to synthesize them as best I can. And certainly, I there's no way I'm right about everything. And I accept that, like, I'm probably wrong about most of it. But you have to, like, make some conclusions before you can, I guess, change your mind.
Right. There's the Huxley-Orwell dichotomy, where you have Orwell has a fear that all information will be withheld and suppressed, and that we will not, you know, be privy to any information that would liberate humanity. And then there's the Huxley idea that we'll have complete overload of information so that we won't be able to tell what's what. It's all cancels out into disinformation because we don't know what to do with it because there's so fucking much. So there's so many sides. And both seem to be occurring.
Yeah, again, embracing the paradox and, like, understand that they can coexist.
Well, young man, have you had enough?
Yes.
Sit down, sit down. Then you finally figured out what's happening here, hmm?
No.
Oh, that's a shame. We'd like to release you as soon as possible.
Do you mean if I figure it out, I can go?
That is one of the things you'll have to figure out.
And that's the kind of a remark I'm getting sick of. This whole thing just isn't real.
Define reality.
Yeah.
Look, is this hammer real?
Yes. No. Maybe.
Possibly all three. Now consider this. If you were to magnify this hammer's head, you would see the geometric latticework of the molecules, permeated by space.
Here we go.
And yet, inside the molecules, we see the atoms. And inside the atoms, we see protons, positrons, neutrons, mesons, mu mesons, pi mesons. And in none of them anywhere can you find anything that you could call a real thing, an actual speck, a thing that you could hold or touch.
You're absolutely right. This hammer, it doesn't exist.
Then how do you explain this? Your trouble is you will not accept a paradox.
Down, down, down you go. No way to stop. As you fall, hear me call. No, no, no. Listen to this warning and consider these simple words of advice. Stop, stop, stop.
Fogging the view, cupping face to the window. In darkness, you make out a spiraling shape. out your hands and you fall through the window and clawing at nothing, you drop through the void. Your terrified screams are inaudible, drowned in the spiral ahead and consumed in the shape. The spiraling shape will move.